Hi, we have some exciting news. Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can listen to all of them right now with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of the show's page.
This is Crime House.
At 4 a.m. on November 13th, 2022, a masked man slipped through an unlocked sliding door. One roommate heard crying and a voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." She even saw him walk past her in the dark. So how did the killer get in? And why did he leave witnesses alive? Because this wasn't just a brutal quadruple homicide. It exposed how vulnerable we really are, even in the places that feel safest. Today, we go inside the house at King Road, examine the evidence that cracked the case, and unpack how the 2022 Idaho murders became one of the most haunting crimes of our generation. Every crime tells a story about the people involved, the system that tried to stop it, and the nation that couldn't look away. Some cases are so shocking, so deeply woven into who we are that decades later, we're still asking, how did this happen? I'm Katie Ring, and this is America's Most Infamous Crimes. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, I'll take you deep into cases that have a lasting imprint on society and still haunt us today. I want to thank you for being part of our Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes wherever you get your podcasts. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Around 4 a.m. on November 13th, 2022, an intruder silently slipped into the house at 1122 King Road in Moscow, Idaho. Dylan Mortensen got woken up by some kind of commotion, and when she peeked her head out of her room, she saw a man wearing a mask walk right past her and out of the house. Dylan could only see the eyes and the distinctive bushy eyebrows, but she knew she hadn't ever seen him before. When Dylan told her housemate Bethany Funk what she'd seen, both girls were terrified, especially when their other housemates, Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonzalez, and Zana Kernodle, and Zana's boyfriend, Ethan Chapin, didn't answer their phones. Around 11 a.m. the next morning, Dylan and Bethany called their friends Hunter, Emily, and Josie. The girls waited outside while Hunter went in to look around, and he quickly found Zana and Ethan's dead bodies in Zana's room. When he came back out, he said to call 911, although to avoid making the situation worse, he only said he'd found someone unconscious. But they were all about to find out just how bad it really was. One of the biggest questions about this case is why Dylan and Bethany waited so long to call 911. And while it might not make sense to most people, you have to remember the situation they were in. They were two young, 19-year-old college kids living in a party neighborhood known for getting noise violations, and they had just gotten back from a night of drinking. Both of them were at least intoxicated, so already not in the best headspace. And Dylan already knew that she would constantly overreact to anything that would slightly scare her. Add shock in there, and it's not the best mixture for clarity. I can't even imagine trying to wrap my head around something this awful. And they were about to find out it went beyond their worst nightmares. Right around noon on the 13th, within minutes of receiving the 911 call, officers from the Moscow Police Department arrived on scene. One of them was 22-year-old Mitch Nunez. He'd only been on the force for a year or so, and he had no idea what he was getting into. Because of the language in the 911 call, Officer Nunez was under the impression that someone inside was passed out. Maybe they'd needed CPR or a defibrillator, but when Hunter took him inside to Zana's room, he realized what he was really dealing with. There was blood everywhere. Nunez could immediately tell that this wasn't just an overdose or a medical event. He could tell that Zana and Ethan had been repeatedly stabbed. Zana was on the floor while Ethan was in the bed, still partially covered by a blanket, which made Nunez think he'd been stabbed in his sleep. The moment he saw this, Nunez knew he needed backup. So he radioed for all available detectives to respond to 1122 King Road immediately. Then he went upstairs to check on Maddie and Kaylee. And the second he got up there, his heart sank. Maddie's bedroom door was cracked open, and Nunez could see her and Kaylee were covered in blood, just like Xana and Ethan. When he got closer, he noticed that Kaylee and Maddie were both lying under a pink blanket. It was clear to him that they'd had no idea what was coming. Nunez was also pretty sure that the same person attacked all four students, since Kaylee and Maddie's wounds were similar to Xana and Ethan's. And a warning, what I'm going to describe is pretty graphic. There was a large gash on the right side of Maddie's face and visible knife wounds on her forearm and hands. The injuries to Kaylee's face were so severe, it was hard to recognize her. Thankfully, backup arrived extremely quickly, and one of the senior officers named Sergeant Shane Gunderson took the lead. The first thing he did was make sure that the crime scene wasn't contaminated by having Kaylee's dog Murphy, who hadn't been hurt, taken to the local Humane Society so her ex-boyfriend could pick him up. Meanwhile, Sergeant Gunderson and his team took a closer look at the victims. They started in Xana's bedroom on the northwest side of the second floor. Here's what they observed. There was blood smeared on the floor and splattered all over the walls, including a portion of the wall above Xana's body. She was in her underwear and a gray shirt, both of which were covered in blood. Her face and body were caked in dried blood, and there were defensive wounds on her hands, including a deep gash on her left hand between her pointer finger and thumb. Later, the medical examiner would identify over 50 stab wounds to Xana's body, including fatal lacerations to her heart and one to her right lung. She mostly sustained defensive wounds on her hands, arms, and face. The investigators could tell that Xana had put up a fight, and based on how close her body was to the bedroom door, it looked like she had been attacked in that spot and had tried to fight off her assailant before succumbing to her injuries, which would mean that the attacker then moved on to Ethan, who was asleep in bed. Gunderson's team found Ethan lying on his back on a blood-soaked mattress, with stab wounds on the back of his legs and under his left clavicle, which severed the subclavian vein. According to the medical examiner, his jugular vein had also been severed, which would explain Ethan's extreme level of blood loss. It was so bad that the investigators noticed that Ethan's blood had seeped outside through the wall of the house. It was clear that whoever killed them was violent, sadistic, and full of rage. And then Sergeant Gunderson went upstairs to examine Maddie and Kaylee, and he saw just how heartbreaking this crime really was. Both victims had suffered multiple stab wounds, and it was clear that the two young women had been brutally murdered in their bed. By this point, Sergeant Gunderson could barely process everything he was seeing, but when he got a closer look at everything Kaylee went through, he realized the extent of the horror. Gunderson noted that Kaylee's facial structure was, quote, extremely damaged, which was in line with Officer Nunez's observation that she was unrecognizable. The ME would also find two subdural bleeds, which is bleeding in the brain. Not only that, but Kaylee was the only victim whose wounds showed signs of strangulation. It was clear that the Moscow Police Department had their work cut out for them, and they weren't afraid to admit it. They'd never dealt with a crime scene this sudden and violent. But they did know how important it was to keep the details of this investigation under wraps, because the killer was still out there, and if too much information got out, it might help them cover their tracks. Although they were communicating with officials from the University of Idaho about what happened, the university didn't realize that they needed to keep everything quiet on their end, and they sent out a campus safety alert, informing all students that there had been a quadruple homicide on King Road. And that's how the victims' friends and their families learned what really happened. The guy Dylan saw the night before wasn't a prankster or some sketchy random person. It was a killer, her friend's killer. And before the day was over, the police would discover a crucial piece of evidence.
On this show, we're always digging for the truth. Yet modern healthcare remains one of the greatest mysteries of all. Everyone deserves real medical support. And that's why I want to talk about Mochi Health. Mochi is a nationwide platform that's bringing humanity and transparency back to healthcare by treating your unique biology, not a fad. They've already helped 400,000 members lose over 5 million pounds, and while they lead the way in weight loss, Mochi is now a full-scale marketplace for over 120 treatments, ranging from hair and skin care to longevity, mental health, and specialized men's and women's health. After you complete an eligibility form, you'll receive a telehealth evaluation with a partnered provider on Mochi's platform to build a plan personalized for your specific body and goals. You'll have 24/7 access to your provider and specialized medications from a network of licensed pharmacies delivered right to your door. No waiting rooms or hidden fees. You just pay for your membership and your medication. It's personalized care that actually treats you like a human being. Stop leaving your health up to an algorithm. Go to joinmochi.com. Hi, listeners. It's Carter Roy, host of Murder True Crime Stories. I wanted to let you know that Crime House Plus and Murder True Crime Stories are celebrating America's 250th by dropping a four-part limited series on the crimes that built America. These are the crimes and cases that gave us Miranda rights, sparked criminal profiling, and a murder that built America's missing children movement. Follow Murder True Crime Stories for a new episode every Monday leading up to July 4th, or you can binge all of them right now ad-free with Crime House Plus. To join, go to crimehouseplus.com, or if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, tap Try Free at the top of this show's page.
Once the campus alert went out about the murders at 1122 King Road, it was up to Dylan, Bethany, and their friends to break the news to the victims' families. They called Ethan's fellow triplets, Hunter and Maisie, to tell them that the campus safety alert was about their brother. Ethan was dead. Hunter and Maisie then called their mom. They were so upset she couldn't really understand them, but she knew she had to get to them. The news also reached Zana's sister, Jasmine, who went to Washington State University, just 10 miles away. She called their dad, but she couldn't break the news to him over the phone, so she just told him to go to Moscow, and he did. Up in northern Idaho, Kaylee and Maddie's families were both starting to get concerning messages from the girls' friends, but no one could get a hold of Kaylee or Maddie. So far, all anyone knew for sure was that Zana and Ethan were dead. Kaylee's parents called Maddie's mom to see if they knew what was going on. She said she was already on her way to campus and promised to bring both girls home when she found them. The confusion lasted until late afternoon when the police finally confirmed it and broke the news that no parent ever wants to hear. Kaylee, Maddie, Ethan, and Zana were never coming home. Meanwhile, the police started bringing people down to the station to give statements, including the surviving roommates Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk. Bethany didn't have much to add other than what Dylan had told her that she'd seen the night before. And on top of those details, Dylan also shared the weird interactions Kaylee had in the weeks leading up to the murders, like the guy she saw watching her while she was walking her dog, and when she'd been followed around the grocery store about a week after that. Dylan also described the day they all came home to find their front door wide open and the washing machine turned on. It was starting to seem like the killer stalked the victims before the night of the attack. And since most of the victims were young women, investigators thought the killings might have been sexually motivated. That question would become a little more complicated when the medical examiner told them that none of the victims showed signs of sexual assault. But that didn't necessarily mean the crimes weren't sexually motivated. Based on the nature of the victims' injuries, the ME could tell that the killer used a non-serrated, single-edged, very sharp weapon. In other words, a knife. Not only that, but the killer used a lot of force while stabbing the victims. According to some criminologists, this kind of stabbing indicates a sexual motive. It's something known as piquerism, which is a sexual fetish where someone is aroused by penetrating the skin with a sharp object. As a killing method, piquerism is often a substitute for sexual assault. Others thought that the crime could have been originally sexually motivated, but that intentions changed when he found Maddie and Kaylee together, and the rage of his original plan not working out took over. It was definitely a compelling idea, but before the police could be sure about this theory or any others, they needed to collect more evidence. And around 4 p.m. on the 13th, they found something crucial. Back at the house on King Road, even more backup had arrived, including Corporal Brett Payne from the Moscow Police Department. He helped secure and inspect the crime scene and found evidence that nobody had noticed yet. On the bed in Maddie's room, Payne found a leather knife sheath with a Marine Corps insignia on it. It was for a special type of knife called a K-bar, which became the Marines' official knife during World War II. Now, K-bar knives aren't an actual brand, although there is currently a company called K-bar Knives, Inc., which manufactures them. But over the decades, a lot of different companies have made K-bar knives, and their purpose is specifically for combat. They're advertised as self-defense alternatives to guns. One of the other officers on the scene was Idaho State Police Lieutenant Darren Gilberson, who was a Marine Corps veteran. So he knew a lot about K-bars, including that they had a reputation for their tips breaking off during combat. So he wondered if maybe a piece had broken off when Maddie and Kaylee were attacked, which could help them get more information on the knife. Maybe even what specific model was used. Unfortunately, it seemed like the knife had stayed intact. The leather sheath looked pretty new, and even though it had the Marine Corps logo on it, anyone can buy a sheath like that. So the police tracked down all the K-bar knives that had been sold in the area recently, and none of them were a match, which meant the killer had probably bought the knife online, and that would make it basically impossible to track down. But the sheath was still valuable evidence since it could have fingerprints or DNA on it. So they sent it to the Idaho Crime Lab for testing. And in the meantime, they started tracking down other leads. Investigators also found a partially visible shoe print outside of Dylan's bedroom door. It had repeated diamond shapes, which is pretty typical with the sole of a Vans brand shoe. The print was directly in the path that Dylan had described the intruder taking as he left the house. So it was most likely the suspect's footprint. It was another promising piece of evidence, but it still wasn't enough to point them in the right direction. What they really needed was a sense of the killer's movements. So detectives started combing through footage from Ring cameras around the neighborhood. And that's when they found something chilling. A video of a white Hyundai Elantra circling King Road multiple times in the early morning hours of November 13th. Then at around 4:20 a.m., the same car was seen speeding away from the area. It was the best lead they had so far. If they could find the vehicle, they could find the driver, and maybe they would find their killer. Based on the fact that he went straight to Maddie's room, it seemed like this was a targeted attack, like the killer already knew who he wanted to go after. The question was, who was he? And why would he want to kill Maddie, Kaylee, Zanna, and Ethan? To answer that, investigators tried to find a connection, and there was an obvious one, Greek life. All four victims were part of a sorority or a fraternity, and not only that, but at the time of the murders, Maddie, Zanna, and Kaylee's sororities were the only ones on campus that were currently suspended for issues involving alcohol, drugs, or hazing. That made the police wonder if the murders were alcohol or drug related. And remember, in the hours leading up to the murders, the victims and their surviving roommates were all drinking and partying. Ethan and Zanna went to a party at Sigma Chi, and Kaylee and Madison spent about 3 hours at a local bar called the Corner Club. The police talked to a lot of people about it, but the leads came up empty. The Uber driver who brought Maddie and Kaylee home that night was clear too, and so was the DoorDasher who delivered Zanna's food. There was also a mysterious guy in the hoodie from the food truck. He was eliminated as a suspect, but there hasn't been any information released about him beyond that. So it didn't seem like anyone in town would have wanted to hurt any of the victims, which meant authorities had to expand their search beyond Moscow, and they had a pretty good idea of where to start looking. The footage of the white Hyundai Elantra was the best lead authorities had so far. An FBI specialist determined it was a model between 2011 and 2013, which helped narrow things down a lot. And even though there wasn't any video footage of exactly where the car had gone, investigators were able to come up with a working theory by using the process of elimination based on where the car didn't show up on security camera footage in the area. They suspected that the sedan left Idaho State entirely, heading into the direction of Pullman, Washington, which is another college town about 10 miles away from Moscow, right on the Washington-Idaho border. The theory made a lot of sense because Pullman is the closest city to Moscow, so there were a lot of people there. And if the killer had specifically targeted the victims, chances were he would be around their age. So the Moscow PD got in touch with their counterparts in Pullman, who did a little video canvassing of their own. And the Pullman PD found security footage of what appeared to be a 2014 to 2016 white Hyundai Elantra with no front license plate driving around town, including on the Washington State University campus there, around 5:25 a.m. on November 13th, just an hour after the murders. And on November 29th, 16 days after the murders, two separate Washington State University campus police officers told the Moscow PD that they had previously spotted a car that fit the description, a 2015 white Hyundai Elantra with the Pennsylvania license plate LFZ8649. For reference, Pennsylvania doesn't require a front license plate, but both Washington and Idaho do. So that explained why it didn't have a front plate, and it helped them narrow down the search in a huge way. Because now that they had the plate, they also got a hit on the driver's license. He was a 28-year-old white male studying for a PhD in criminology at WSU. The license plate said he was 6 feet tall and 185 pounds. And from the picture, they could see he clearly had bushy eyebrows, just like Dylan had described. And best of all, they had a name, Brian Koberger. But the investigation was far from over. At the end of each episode, we'll be going off the record where I'll give my thoughts about the case and answer any questions you've submitted.
What are your thoughts on the victim's injuries and a possible motive?
If you've been following this case, they have been releasing new evidence slowly. And last month, they released the autopsies of the victims. And I'm going to go into it because, warning, it's pretty brutal, but I knew this crime was obviously violent and brutal, but after reading these autopsies, it gives you a whole new perspective of like the sheer brutality of it. So let's start with Kaylee. First, her cause of death was sharp force injuries. She had 24 plus stab and incised wounds to scalp, face, and neck, 11 stab wounds to the chest, 3 stab wounds to the upper extremities, punctures of the outer table of the skull, injuries to the teeth and tongue, perforations of the subclavian artery and vein, hemorrhage into the chest cavities. Blunt force injuries include scalp laceration, bleeding around the brain, nasal fracture, scrapes on nose and cheeks, bruising around the eyes, pattern bruises extending across the lower face, hemorrhages in the eyes and mouth, and a blood alcohol content of 0.107. Before the autopsy, we knew the injuries to Kaylee were pretty severe, but hearing the exact injuries and seeing where they are on the body really gives you an idea of how actually violent this was and how much damage was done to Kaylee, which is extremely sad. For Madison Mogan, it is the same cause of death, multiple sharp force injuries. She had 13 stab wounds to the scalp, face, and neck, 5 stab wounds to the chest, 10 wounds to the upper extremities, wounds on the lung and liver, perforations, veins, arteries, and blood vessels of the chest wall, incision of the nasal septum, perforation of the tongue, and fluid in the lower airways. The BAC is 0.282. Zanna also had very extensive injuries. The cause of death is the same, multiple sharp force injuries. She had 23 stab wounds to the scalp, face, and neck, 7 stab wounds to the chest, 4 stab wounds to the abdomen, 3 puncture wounds to the back, 25 wounds to the upper extremities, 5 wounds to the lower extremities, punctures to the outer table of the skull, perforations of the jugular vein, heart, lung, and pulmonary blood vessels, hemorrhages in the chest cavities, wounds extending into the bones of the right hand, scrapes and bruises on the face, torso, and extremities, and a BAC of 0.229. So again, before these autopsies were released, we knew that Zanna really fought back and had these defensive wounds. And you can see, you know, even going to the bone on her hands, seeing that's how much she fought back. Similar to Kaylee, we knew that Zanna had pretty extensive injuries, and we knew that she really fought back and she had these defensive wounds, which you can really see here, especially to her upper extremities. Her hand got cut all the way to the bone. So you could really see that Zanna fought back here, and it was just terribly violent. Last, we have Ethan, who had 4 stab wounds to the scalp, face, and neck, 1 stab wound to the upper chest, 6 incised wounds to the upper extremities, 6 stab wounds to the lower extremities, perforations of the jugular vein, subclavian vein, and subclavian arteries, and a BAC of 0.122. So in total, that's about 150 or even more stab wounds in 15 to 20 minutes. And I'll go into this in the next episode because we got new documents about what Koberger's lawyers were going to argue and what the experts were going to argue. But Koberger did plead guilty and he didn't say anyone else was involved. And I personally think that this was just an insane amount of adrenaline. Obviously, the injuries to Kaylee and Maddie, especially Kaylee, you know, at first were really intense. I do think it was sexually motivated, and I think it was sexually motivated towards Kaylee. I think Kaylee was the intended victim. Obviously, we don't know, and that's just speculation, but the fact that she was the only one who was strangulated kind of shows that. And I do think that maybe his plan was interrupted, and that's why he just had this rage, and then he just needed to kill all the witnesses. I think Dylan got away because, as we saw, there was the mark on the chair that clearly said that he had to take a break after killing four people and stabbing people this many times and doing these injuries. Some people also are claiming now that there were two weapons used, except if you know a K-bar, it's a knife on one side and the other side is basically a hammer. So I don't think it was two weapons used. I think it was just each side of the K-bar. I think he used the butt end of the K-bar to hit. And I think he even had, someone said that he might have had gloves with hard knuckles on them. So I don't think it was two people. He's already pled guilty to this. I know people are going to hate that in the comments, but that is my personal opinion. But seeing these autopsies and the drawings of where these stab wounds hit and how just the sheer amount really speaks to the rage. And I agree with Steve Gonzalez that I'm surprised that the death penalty was taken off the table here because it's really disturbing how insane this was. I have a lot of thoughts on this investigation, and we'll go more into them in the episode tomorrow. But from the beginning, I think the fact that they didn't reach out to the parents, the fact that that wasn't the first thing they did, I think is really disturbing, and that people weren't finding out until the University of Idaho released this warning to the campus. So I think there was just a lot of failures in communication on every level. And again, yeah, we'll go into more of what I think in tomorrow's episode, but there was definitely a lot that they could have done better with this investigation. Thanks so much for joining me for this episode. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to subscribe. If you're listening on audio, please rate, review, and follow America's Most Infamous Crimes. And to get all episodes at once ad-free, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. Come back tomorrow for our final episode on the Idaho College murders.